JFK, Knights Templars, 1,000 years of history leading up to our times, with VT's Paul Fitzgerald and Liz Gould, right here, right now, on
VT Radio. Let's go. With host Johnny Punish.
Okay, and we're back on VT Radio with Paul Fitzgerald and Liz Gould, all the way from, I believe it's Boston, Massachusetts. Is that right?
Right.
Fantastic. Welcome back to VT Radio, as always, Paul and Liz. So great to have you. I hear you have some exciting news. JFK assassination, 60th anniversary. Tell us about this event coming up.
Well, every year, for many years now, there has been a convention in Dallas focused on the assassination of JFK, and all kinds of people who have been very high-level people. I mean, Oliver Stone's film, I think, was shown last year with, I believe, what was the guy?
His documentary.
The guy that I told you who was there.
Jim DiEugenio.
Yeah, yeah. DiEugenio actually made the presentation last year at the event. And so we have actually been extended an invitation to basically talk about the esoteric history behind the assassination that really has never entered into the discussion. And we are not sure why. In fact, we actually introduced Oliver Stone to that information in 1992. After we saw his film JFK, we had actually started doing the research on the Fitzgerald family due to, you know, Paul's, his, you know, personal history going back, you know, through the Fitzgerald family. So we were doing that research back then. And when we saw the film JFK, we said, there's an esoteric history. We've got to make Oliver Stone aware of that. He needs to do that film next. So we put together the research we had at the time, and we basically told him about it, and he accepted that we would do a meeting. And we talked about it. Ultimately, he chose our Afghanistan story instead. He said, I just finished JFK, and it was a, you know, he said, I just can't do another JFK film right now.
Excuse the pun, but it was a big hit, wasn't it?
Right. Oh, yes, yeah. Yes. Yeah. But the point being that it's now 2023, Oliver.
Right. Oliver, where are you?
Is it time? Right. But that's what we're going to be presenting, pretty much what we gave him back in 1992. But we've done a lot more research into it. But it's only in adding layers and layers of understanding that are now in our books, The Valediction.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's really interesting the way you wind up thinking, gee, this is an interesting subject. Let's just probe this a little bit, you know, and you probe it and you discover all this stuff comes out, you know, that you had never even suspected. You say, gee, I always knew there was something there, you know, but I didn't know exactly what it meant. And then you discover bit by bit by bit by bit that there's this huge story on there about the Fitzgerald background that goes back to, you know, 1169 when they came to Ireland, and even before that. You know, when the Fitzgerald family, it goes back to 1066, the Battle of Hastings. And then prior to that, it goes back to, I mean, they're still debating as to what exactly. There is clearly an Italian family connection between the Fitzgeralds and Italy. And they debate back and forth as to exactly what it, I believe it's Gherardino was the name of the family. So,
well, even JFK,
he even admitted it.
There was an article done by one of the major magazines
in Italy
while he was president, possibly visiting Italy. I'm not sure.
Yes, he was visiting,
right. Yeah. And it was focused on the Italian connection to the Fitzgerald family.
Really? Didn't he visit the Pope because he was the first Catholic U.S. president? Was that when that was, or did I get that wrong?
I don't know.
I don't recall whether that was part of it or not, but I know that he did come out and make a speech, and he said, we haven't spoken about this in the family until, you know, just recently. He said, but because I'm president now, I get to say that, you know, my background goes beyond Ireland and goes back to Italy. So he did make a speech in which he included that. Wow. So.
And he may have visited the Pope, but I'm sure he also had to be very careful not to give anyone in this country who was a Protestant the impression that Rome was running.
Oh, I see.
That was the time of John the 23rd, too. Yeah. So that there was a lot of controversy about the Vatican Council and the changes that were happening in the church at that time. So it was a very, not just a volatile political issue, it was a military issue at the time. It was also a volatile Christian and Catholic issue.
Right. You mentioned the Italian portion of the Fitzgeralds. you know, the rumor goes around that, you know, JFK was actually assassinated by the Italian mafia, so to speak. You know, I don't know the details of that. And there's a lot of different theories on that. Can you give me your impression of that? Am I barking up the wrong tree here?
Well, I don't think the mafia, you know, that they're talking about has any connection at all to the Fitzgerald lineage.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I could be wrong on that. I mean, I really am making an assumption, but you know, the idea of the mafia that was working with the U.S. at the time. I mean, we know that there was a lot of issues that were going on vis-a-vis Cuba. You know, it was a big issue that the mob was involved in because of the gambling that obviously, you know, ended because of the rise of Castro and all of that. And what happened when JFK got into office and they tried the Bay of Pigs, they pulled the Bay of Pigs off at that time to try and force his hand. And, you know, so all the issues that right. were associated with it. I don't get the impression, though, it was in any way connected to the Fitzgerald lineage.
I mean, from everything that we've heard about, everything we've read, people that have talked to us. I mean, Al Lowenstein, who was working on Bobby Kennedy's campaign and Jack's campaign did a great deal of investigation into it, claimed 2 weeks before he was killed by an assassin that he had all the people willing to come forward. Yeah. And he implied that the people were very well aware that this was a government operation, that this was a secret operation conducted by the government. And if the mafia did in some way, or certain gangsters had a hand in it, it certainly was, they were not the planning operation.
Right.
The planning operation was done from a very high level. It was probably international. It probably had something to do with the Gladio group, which was focused in Italy at the time. And there were some other aspects to it that, you know, that may have incorporated, mafia connections here and there. But certainly and I think Robert Kennedy Jr. has come out. He just last week stated the fact that the CIA had killed his father.
Now, Robert Kennedy Jr., he's the gentleman that's running for president in 2024.
That's running for president right now.
Another Fitzgerald.
And he admitted.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
The Fitzgeralds are behind this, you know, from the very beginning. If you read Doris Kearns Goodwin's book about the Kennedys and the Fitzgeralds, it, you know, the Fitzgeralds were a dynamic aspect of what was going on in the Boston political scene back in the late 19th and early 20th century. and so if you go back to Ireland and you look at the history, I mean, Trinity College put out a book a few years ago. They had a huge conference about the Fitzgeralds and their legacy in Ireland. And they are trying to figure out all these different aspects of the family. And, you know, it was a real academic study that they conducted. And it's really kind of hard to pin it down. If you look at the esoteric aspects of it, you can see that, you know, it was written up in the 14th and 15th century. One of the members of the Fitzgerald family was Geraldus Cambrensis, Gerald of Wales. And he was a Barry. His mother and father were, he was a grandson of Gerald of Windsor and Nesta, who was the Princess of Wales. And this would have been in the 12th century.
The origin of the Fitzgerald family
in Ireland.
That marriage.
And so as a result of that, you know, they talked about that then, and they talked about the family going back to Troy and about the fact, the foundation, that they were part of the foundation of Rome. So, you know, if that is in any way contributing factor to the authenticity of Camelot legend and what JFK represented, then we're dealing with something that's very deeply esoteric and that goes a long way back in history. And you've got feud upon feud upon feud. I mean, all those families from the Roman Empire and all those families from Troy, you know, whether we think it's real or important or not, they think it's real and important. And I think that's what we have to keep in mind.
Right. Well, I think the important thing here historically to establish is the significance of the Knights Templar and the origin of the history surrounding the belief that there were real esoteric reasons why the actual assassination was carried out by people who were aware of that history that goes back to the 12th century, that goes back to the suppression of the Knights Templar by the King of France and the Pope, that eventually led to the total suppression of the Knights Templar, where all their holdings were actually taken over, and they were completely dispossessed, and it was believed that they went off into Britain, and that's where they were taken in Scotland and Britain. And this part of the legend that eventually they came back sort of in the form of the Masons, or they were embedded into the Masonic world, and that was their cover, so to speak. Well, it had everything to do with the fact that that suppression happened on November 22nd, 1307. Does that date ring a bell with anybody?
A little bit.
Hello. Yeah. Well, there you go. And it's actually, the date was considered the day of revenge by the, it's the 30th degree of Masonry, right?
Yes.
Right. So that date and the act of revenge were very connected. So this is why when you begin to read the esoteric symbols, you can see there's quite a heavy duty meaning there. But when you add in then that the origin of the OSS and Wild Bill Donovan, who was the first man to run the OSS, he referred to the agents as Knights Templars. Now, you might say, oh, that was just cute. He was just, you know, this can't be real. Mm. How about it is real? How about it is actually real?
You've got a Gnostic strain of ancient religious beliefs that has run through history for the past couple of thousand years. If I might just read this quote from the article that we wrote and that we sent to you. As described by Reverend V.A. DeMott, who was the canon of London St. Paul's Cathedral, in a preface to his 1947 book on the subject titled The Arrow and the Sword, quote, "To mention only its roots in Mithraism, its links with the Gnostics, its theological dualism, its asceticism, the ritual of life and death as cosmic mysteries, the appeal of the troubadours, Arthurian legends, and the cult of the Holy Grail, the passions aroused for and against witchcraft, the intimate connection between sex and religion, all these things are sufficient testimony to the deep-rooted vitality of a stream of religious consciousness which cannot be superciliously dismissed by rationalists and moralists." So this is coming from the rector at St. Paul's Cathedral, who is the head of the Anglican Church, talking about this strain of Gnosticism. Now, that was in 1947. You know, these things have been built. I think a lot of the things that we are facing today, the rise of Catharism again, the rise of the Gnostic core that has been underneath the surface, behind the groups like the Knights Templar, things like that. It's worked its way in and out of the system over the last couple of thousand years. And I think where the Catharism, the idea that, and the Gnosticism being that the humanity is basically corrupted, that it was a mistake, that the creation of humanity was a mistake, and that the objective is to become a completely spiritual being, to leave your body and ascend.
And never have to come back again.
And that is the underlying belief system of a lot of religions. Judaic religions, Judeo-Christian religions. So, I mean, the fact is that we are living with this in and out of it. There is a scenario at work that we become aware of periodically. We bump into it. It presents itself as in the assassination of JFK. And people are left wondering, what was that really all about? And what we discover is the fact that it was really all about this ancient Gnostic struggle that's been going on for struggle for power, the objective of which is to eliminate the human race from the planet, I think.
I would have to add quickly, though, the important thing about understanding that the people who are today talking about things like the mafia had a motivation and all these different groups had motivation, those all actually did all have motivation, but what very few people factor in is this underlying motivation and how much it is in fact within the CIA that these belief systems really play a role, And that's my point about bringing up Wild Bill Donovan and him calling his agents Knights Templars and taking that seriously rather than thinking that's really just,
Is the average person just not seeing this? Is it just so hidden? Or what do you think about that?
I mean, you have this struggle between the exoteric aspects of religion and the esoteric aspects of religion. And the fact is that most people who go to Mass on Sunday or who, who prescribe to religions of any kind, basically are only happy with the ritual, with the pageant, and satisfied with that. The fact is that the esoteric aspect of it is pretty much left up to the priests, the high priests. And the higher up you go on the ladder of understanding, I mean, how many of us have ever had a chance to go through the Vatican Library and look at some of the texts that have been kept for 2,000 years.
Basically.
Hidden,
Yes, very hidden.
The fact that you'd need to speak Greek, you'd need to, in order to really understand what it is, you'd need to read Latin, you'd need to read Greek, you'd need to read a half a dozen different ancient languages in order to understand exactly what it was.
If you could ever see it.
If you could ever get to see it. Yeah, exactly. So, there you just have to realize, you have to accept the fact that, first of all, we live in this unfortunate age when anybody who doesn't believe what they're told to believe by the mainstream media is called a conspiracy theorist. Well, the fact is that there are conspiracies. That's not difficult. Everyone knows that. And the law knows that, too. But the fact is that, things happen. And if you work for Macy's, as an example, I'm sure that, the top floor of Macy's does not tell the clerks who are selling, handbags on the first floor exactly what their business decisions are going to be, or which stores they're going to close, or where they're going to open new ones. You're not part of that discussion. And I think that we all understand that, you just don't get invited to those parties.
Right.
So, here we are, right, realizing that there is definitely a scenario. There's something else going on here, and we've not been informed as to what it is.
I get a lot of questions from people, friends of mine. They're always asking me, so what's going on with the government? What's the real story? What's this? What's that? And they start talking about the issues. And most of them are, they're average Joes. They have a, full-time job. And if they're lucky, they get to spend 30 minutes a day investigating the news, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And my answer always is, you know what? You're not invited to the party. Whatever you're being told, whatever you're hearing is just a little part of it, but unfortunately, you just don't know what's going on because they're doing it without you, behind your back, and you're not going to be invited to that party. And frankly, I'm not either. So, what can I tell you? It's a tough situation for democracy.
There was a guy at Harvard University a few years ago who wrote a book. We talked to Chuck Kogan about it.
Right.
Called Double Government, I believe it was. And the question he posed was, can the United States actually be a democracy considering the creation of the National Security State in 1947?
Right.
Considering that you have this other separate government that basically makes all kinds of decisions, has an enormous amount of power and influence, an enormous amount of the federal budget at its disposal, and can hide aspects of that. I mean, we've been noticing recently that, the Pentagon is suddenly finding billions of dollars that they can send to Ukraine because they made a tax error or an accounting error. They didn't realize that they were accounting.
Oops.
Like that.
How many billions do you think they're going to find? As many as they need.
Right.
Let me put it that way.
Well, we all know.
Yeah.
That happened.
But this double government idea, he questioned the fund. It was a very high level legal book, actually. He actually questioned, whether we actually have been living in a democracy, and he came to the conclusion by the end of his book is that we haven't. We really, you cannot have two separate governments running the show and still call it a democracy.
Yeah, so. I think a lot of people call it. They always correct me and they'll say something like, "Well, it's a representative republic," but I go, "Yeah, but still, the people on top are not inviting you to that party." So. Yeah, you're voting, but you're voting for your representative, and your representative is going off voting for the corporatocracy that's taking their money, that's giving them the money, and then we're left in the dust. We have influence over our local city councils. I know that for sure, because one time I went to the city council and I got the zoning change in my city, so I know I have an influence in my local town. That's true. I've done that before, but anything above that, I get stonewalled, and it's just, it's weird, you know? What do you say about that?
Well, you know, I think the Greeks realized that, you know, once you made the population beyond a certain point, the very concept of democracy didn't work anymore. It really had to be local. It had to be personal. And you had to take a personal involvement in it. And once you got beyond, I don't know, 5,000 or 8,000 people that needed to be governed by this thing you call democracy, it got out of control.
Yeah, can I ask you a question about the Greeks? Which Greek, was it one Greek philosopher said this, or was it the whole idea of the Greek democracy? Because it really was the nobles that were voting, not the average person. Is that right in Greek history?
Exactly.
Can you explain that to me, please?
You had the same thing in Rome as well. You had an elite, you had the Senate, and then you had the plebeians, and you basically were told what to do. And then, of course, you had an enormous slave class as well that supported that.
Right.
And it was a very different thing from what we have.
But was it the Greeks that came up with this thing? They always say the Greeks were the first democracy. Is that true?
I would say the Greeks. Well, the Greeks evolved ancient ideas from the Sumerians and the Assyrians. You had, you know, the kind of Euphrates Valley in the area in Afghanistan, in the Indus Valley culture.
Right.
You had these ancient cultures that came up with some very sophisticated rules and laws and taxation, because once you got a society to a certain point and the rulers wanted to maintain their control, they had to figure out a way of making everybody happy.
Right. Well, one of the things, for instance, that's very interesting about the Afghans is that they had a code of life that was called Pashtunwali. That's over 5,000 years old. And when you go back to the origin of what are called Pashtuns, is what they were originally called, you know, this is what guided their life. In fact, when Islam came in, it has only been for hundreds of years, really, the major religion in Afghanistan. And in fact, when it comes to a competition, at least this would have been pre-1979, when the horrors began to happen to Afghanistan, Pashtunwali actually held sway over the overall thinking. Mm-hmm. And these laws included very open-minded ideas about the equality between men and women. It had advanced concepts about how to create. They had what was called a loya jirga. And at these jirgas, the respected members of the community had certain rights to very much represent the people. But they had a way of allowing for a sense of exchange. So it wasn't literally called democracy, but it really operated at a very profound level as a kind of natural democracy, mm-hmm. in that sense. And so and many people, unfortunately, and especially after what happened in 1979 and up until now, had completely, literally atomized this 5,000-year-old culture that was very sophisticated. Mm-hmm. And it was very much, you could say that, you know, this is something that I'm sure it's not the only country that has suffered this fate either. But the worst thing, I feel, is that not only did they lose it all, but most people have no idea they had it in the first place.
Yeah, that's actually true. I think Afghanistan, everybody thinks Afghanistan is what they see on TV right now. No idea of the history of it. None whatsoever. It's really ignorant and embarrassing, actually.
Well, we went back there in 2002, and after the United States had invaded, mm-hmm. and we had been there, of course, in the 80s, and we had helped to try to, you know, brought a negotiator, Roger Fisher, from the Harvard Negotiation Project with us to see if he could figure out a way. He had connections in the Soviet Union with people, with decision makers, and that the objective was to try to figure out a way to get the Soviets, what the Soviets needed in order to go home, to unwind the situation. Mm-hmm. And, that whole process was very complex. Afghanistan was a very complex society. They had had a gradual growing of their democracy over a period of 100 years, preceded by 100 years worth of effort from the top down, from the royalty. I mean, women had the right to vote. What
1923.
Year?
1923.
Women were given the right to vote and in 1923.
An important point. The Afghan women did not ask for that right. It was given to them.
So we went back. It was given to them by the leadership, by the royals and the nobility. And so we went back in 2002 with Sima Wali, who was a member of the royal family, and basically we got an opportunity to sit down with all the different correspondents from all the different news agencies and whatever that were there in 2002. They had absolutely, and including the NGOs that were operating there with the Afghan people, they had absolutely no idea about the background of the Afghan people, of what the culture was that they were dealing with.
It's incredible.
And they basically... I mean, the guy from one of the news services said to me, he said, well, these guys are all very primitive. I mean, look at the guys, you know, the Mujahideen, that crowd, you know, he said, they're medieval. It's medieval. I came here over the plains with one of these assault groups. And he said, hey, this is Middle Ages. It's biblical. And I said, I was here in 1981 and 1983. They used to call this place the Paris of Central Asia, South Central Asia. I said the place was beautiful. The people were beautiful. Right. We had the restaurants were fantastic.
Well, not only that, but at the University of Kabul, 60% of the people at the university were women going to school.
Right.
So the very idea of what Afghanistan was.
And I documented, it was all documented on camera. It was aired on PBS. And, it was just the idea that these people could be civilized was just simply rejected. It was rejected. They didn't want to hear about it in New York or Washington. Yeah. So, we're dealing with a cultural bias from the people that are running the empire.
Right.
And I think that, our own empire, and I think that what's happening right now is that those people who are running it are getting a lesson in the fact that, they have competition now that they have to pay attention to.
Now, I want to go back and talk about your books, because your books – go back into the history of all of this. And can you speak, Liz, a little bit about the books that you guys have written together?
Well, what we did is, we started out as the first journalists to get into Afghanistan. And when we got there in 1981 and saw the fact that the narrative creation process was not at all what we thought it was. It is a process that basically can ignore facts 100%. And they come up with exactly what they want. We came back with a story that contradicted it. And what that did was, over a period of multiple trips and really working with ABC, CBS, PBS, we really realized there was no point in getting more facts, that we had to figure out another way of knowing what was really going on and what was the motivation. And that actually led us out of journalism and into screenwriting. And it turned out that our daughter, 10 years old, woke up one morning, had a dream with Paul's father, who had been deceased. Actually, he died before Alyssa was even born. And he was bringing with him a man who told Alyssa he was 800 years old. And he was wearing a very specific outfit that was very identifiable. It kind of looked like a Scotch plaid outfit, and it looked homemade. And I woke her up. She tells me the story. When Paul hears the story, he said, I have to go look into my Fitzgerald history. 800 years ago was the Norman invasion of Ireland, and the Fitzgerald family basically ran it. So it was like the motivation came from this mystical message. So it just opened us up, naturally to this other way of knowing. And that eventually, I think I mentioned, this brings us back to JFK. It was after we saw Oliver Stone's JFK. This would have been in 1992 when Alyssa had the dream. It was Oliver's film, JFK, came out at the end of 1992. And when we saw that, we knew right away we have to bring him this esoteric history that we began unearthing. When Paul mentioned Heraldus Cambrensis, who was part of the Fitzgerald family, who had documented the Norman invasion of Ireland, which was basically a Fitzgerald history book. And all of the history that came along and the implications that came along. And we were convinced that the motivations right then for the assassination had to include those motivations too, because that history was very prickly between basically London and the Fitzgeralds, who were trying to become the kings of Ireland effectively. And they were becoming the kings of Ireland by basically marrying the Irish clans. And they were actually completely separating from British thinking, British rule. And so this created a threat eventually to London, which ended up in the form of the Desmond Wars, which was a genocide of effectively against the Fitzgeralds, especially the Desmond Fitzgeralds, which is the family line that Paul is from and that JFK is from. They were the ones who really had married the land of Ireland and were willing to die for the people of Ireland.
And they were actually, the last Earl of Desmond was killed, and he was beheaded in 1583. But his father had actually was in negotiations with the Pope at that time to grant Desmond, the southwestern part of Ireland, an independence from London and establish it as a Catholic, basically with Catholic sovereignty. Mm-hmm. So he wanted the sovereignty of this area of Ireland designated as a papal state. Pretty much given papal authority. And so, you know, there was a lot of going back and forth. The Fitzgeralds had been kind of, you know, a thorn in London's side for 400 years. Yeah. And it finally came to a head in that particular instance. And when you get into that, that's when you get into that time period, 1583 into the foundation of the United States. You know, one of the people who was very adamant about destroying the Fitzgerald family, you know, were the people who actually established the Jamestown colony. So Walter Raleigh was actively involved, the Spencers. There was this whole effort, and it was all esoteric. They were all members of what was called the School of Night. Yeah, it was the School of Night that they were participants in. So, you know, and it was all this kind of esoteric science, the kind of stuff that today would be considered physics. You know, quantum physics. These guys were involved with aspects of that back in the 16th century. So, and it was very, and the Gnosticism is very much an aspect of it. So that's where the religious part of it comes in. But it's also, as I said, it's kind of like a 21st century science. And I think we as human beings, in terms of our own evolution, I think are really kind of up against that right at the moment. And unfortunately, in the United States, here we are, the most advanced scientific country in the world, and we are kind of locked into this ideological view of the world that science is some kind of religion, you know, as opposed to being some kind of interactive process whereby we evolve our own consciousness and our own, you know, our own lives with our families. We've been kind of frozen in time here with some antique ideas about the way the world works.
Yep. Now, on the books you wrote, can you name the two books that you wrote for our listeners, please?
Right. Well, it's a memoir. The first one was Valediction, Three Knights of Desmond. It came out in 2021. And then book two is Valediction, Resurrection. And we're working actually on book three.
Oh,
so that,
which is Valediction, Revelation.
Right.
Oh,
but the book two is also out there, 2022. That came out. And what you get is that transition that we went through, viewing the creation of the narrative that really didn't fit any reality we saw, trying to figure out what does this mean, who's doing this, why, and eventually, you know, getting into the nature of the dream and the esoteric part of Hollywood, which we worked with Oliver Stone for 3 years on our Afghanistan project. So we learned a lot about the true dream power role, that the power of the dream is really, it is contained in the active dream experience. And we really experienced it. So that's part of the story. It's the unfolding of that understanding. And then getting into the Fitzgerald history through Alyssa's dream, which was very important because that was Paul connecting to his own father and getting back into that understanding, you know, that was, you know, was ended when Paul's father died when Paul was just 17. So that has become a big part of the story too.
Well, that was also a motivation for me to kind of figure out, well, once again, I need to know more about my father and the family, and I really need to dig into this thing. And so that was a motivation for me personally. And that's what comes through in the Valediction, the three parts of the Valediction. We also did two nonfiction hardcore history books on Afghanistan, which were published in 2009 and 2011, and that's Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story, and Crossing Zero, which it's very interesting to see how Invisible History was really widely received and very popular. And Crossing Zero was our look at what was really going on with the United States during that time period, during the Obama administration. And, you know, you could see the institution just really, like, didn't want to deal with that, you know. So you could see the difference.
Where we thought they were heading, which is exactly where they were heading.
Zero line, yes, exactly. We were just basically trying to inform them that, you know, that... resistance was futile, you know, that they really were not going to be able to do what they thought they were going to do to bring in this new ideological idea that is, you know, they're trying to sweep America and Europe with right at the moment. It just simply wasn't going to, you know, it wasn't going to work in Afghanistan. These people know who they are and they know where they came from. And, you know, we actually, interestingly enough, we got a phone call after one of those, after Invisible History came out. And it was from a member of the Afghan royal family. It was a doctor, and he was actually the king's doctor. He was his cousin, but he was the king's doctor. And he said, you know, he said, I read your book. And he said, you really got into stuff, he said, that nobody else has ever, no Western historian has ever been able to deal with, you know. And he said, my father, he tells us, he said, was the foreign minister for Afghanistan during the 1930s. And he said he spent a lot of time in Berlin. And he said he happened to mention to the German foreign secretary that the origin of the Aryan race was actually Afghans. And he said, you're kidding. So he said, no. And so he gave him the story about how that came to be. And the Indo-Europeans, okay, he said that they were the Indo-Europeans, were the Afghans. They lived up in the mountains, and they needed more land to expand into. So at any rate, so he mentioned it, Ribbentrop mentioned it to Hitler, and Hitler said, I got to meet this guy.
Really?
So it was very interesting. So here we get this phone call from this son of the foreign minister from Afghanistan from the 1930s, mm-hmm. who tells us that, you know, his father got an audience with Hitler. Who was interested in the whole foundation of where, you know, these ethnicities came from and, you know, how we got to be who we were. So, yeah.
That's an incredible
story.
There's
a lot of, yeah, pretty interesting. Huh?
Yeah.
So he had a lot to say about, wonderful guy, very interesting guy. You know, he was a professor at Columbia University and very intelligent guy. So,
you know, in the United States, we're going through right now a lot of, white grievance, white culture. I'm doing a podcast with somebody in an hour or so, the end of white America type of thing, where, you know, people are worried about that their end of their culture is happening and it's going away. And it's strange when we actually look at our history, when you mention stuff like, well, the Aryan, I suppose the white Aryan race may have come from the Afghans, right? I mean, you hear that and you're like, okay, does anybody know that? You know?
Oh, yeah, no question about it. Well, this DNA thing, you know, why DNA business, you know, I had an uncle who was a genealogist and he needed somebody in my family to do it. My two brothers didn't want to do it, so I did it. And boy, did it show up some surprises, you know. And
right. Like the Italian connection?
Like the Italian connection, exactly. You know, that particular strain that we are as Fitzgeralds in that part of Ireland is definitely, you know, when JFK came out and said, we're really Italian, you know, 1,000 years ago, you know.
Yeah, but how about 20,000 years ago?
Well, clearly besides that, exactly. You know, you had this enormous amount of exchange, cultural exchange from North Africa, from the Mediterranean, from the Eastern Mediterranean, from places like Troy. And you find we were watching a BBC documentary about Tintagel, right? Mm-hmm. The home where the Arthurian legend is supposed to have come from. And they're doing an excavation there, and it's absolutely fascinating.
This was only within the last 5 years, I think, something like that.
Yes, within the last 5 years. And this is an area that's in southwestern Wales, mm-hmm. and on the west coast of Wales and on the British coast. And they're finding all this pottery from from what is today Turkey?
Well, one of the things that they actually identified that was incredibly important was the fact that there had been a historical assumption that once the British Empire, Rome, basically dissolved, that that area specifically went into the Dark Ages, because mm-hmm. that would have been the time period of Arthur. But what they discovered archaeologically was there was no evidence of any wars at all. So they had a complete contradiction to right. what the history had claimed versus the archaeological evidence. And I think these are important, I think, revelations for every one of us to take in. It isn't just our current issue, okay, what we, Paul and I, experienced with Afghanistan back in the 1980s, okay, go back to the beginning of the 20th century. We're talking about the origin of history itself being a very, it's an entanglement between myth, which is, I describe mm-hmm. myth as the feelings of what you experience, and that the chronology is the literal, the actual track you took at some level. But there is a marriage that goes on between the chronology and the mythology that produces the story. And that narrative is what we all engage. That's what we all want to enter. That's what gives us mm-hmm. a sense of being and a sense of connection. And what we're living through now is how much that information can be played with. And I don't think it should always be looked at as if it's only evil, that it may be literally natural. I do think that today, though, we have achieved something different with intentional misrepresentation. The CIA and its use of propaganda crosses the line. That is not the same thing as having a perspective that represents what you felt happened genuinely. Okay, you may have missing information. It's very possible new information will change the way you view it, but that's the way it felt to you. That is not the same thing as putting out pure propaganda that is intentionally misleading.
Right. Well, the idea of brainwashing the subject, so to speak.
Yeah. Right. With intentional misrepresentation.
Well, the fact is that, and that's what we came to understand, was the fact that you had this in terms of the genealogical surveys, is that you had a trade, an ancient trade, that went from the Eastern Mediterranean through North Africa, Southern France, Southern Spain, and then right up to the southwestern part of Britain and Ireland as well. They found my DNA from 5,000 years ago in the north of Ireland because of those ancient trade routes from Anatolia all the way through the Mediterranean and all the way up to the top of, up into Scandinavia. Yeah. What we have been taught is, it's kind of like, I liked Kirk Douglas as a Viking raider back when I was, a kid in grammar school, watching those movies. And the fact is that I'm afraid our idea of who we are as Europeans or as people comes from this 1950s idea of which was us against them. We are proponents of a certain history and ideology and everything else, but there's no idea as to how that was mixed and how that came together and where that came from.
I have one of my theories. When I heard the information about the DNA, the actual Fitzgerald DNA going back 5,000 years, I said, maybe what happened to the Fitzgeralds that arrived in 1169 is they reconnected to that ancient root of the land, and that's part of what stirred them to become more Irish than the Irish.
Right.
So I think these kinds of potential understandings can help us become far more creative in the way we interpret what we've been living through.
Yeah. I wanted to share this. I am 75% Middle Eastern. Okay. And I found that out through a DNA test, of course. My father's side is from Sicily. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom is definitely from Palestine. So my mom is born in Haifa, Palestine. So she's definitely Middle Eastern. So I know for sure 50% I'm Middle Eastern, and it's probably ancient because they're from that area as far back as we can tell, 500, almost 1,000 years. Right. But on my dad's side is different because my dad's side would be Sicilian. So it was very strange when I got back my DNA results saying I'm 75% Middle Eastern until I looked back in the history and actually went to Palermo and figured out, wow, there's a bunch of signs here in Arabic. What's going on here? About that, you know, 800 years of Islamic Arab invasion was part of Sicily's history. And obviously, I come from that too. So it's a big mix. So am I a white guy, brown guy? I don't know what I am.
I've got the same. Well, I grew up in a town where I would say, you know, 50% of the people that I went to grammar school with were Sicilian, okay?
Yeah.
And they get very dark in the summertime. The most beautiful girl in our high school, ironically, was she named Queen of the Carnival Ball in my senior year, was named Montefort. Her last name was Montefort, right? Well, it turns out that, you know, as I'm doing the research, and she was Sicilian and absolutely gorgeous, most beautiful girl in my high school class. And I wound up doing this discussion, and I discovered that one of the families that went into Ireland in 1169 were Monteforts. So, you know, the fact was, is that the fact that, you know, when I found out that I had this DNA that went back, you know, to southern Italy and to Sicily, it was very interesting. And the JFK shared that, because that's the same family, the same Fitzgerald family. It was like, I'm beginning to understand something about myself and where these things come from, you know, and where we all come from. And the fact that we are, you know, we are an aggregation of all of these different places and, you know, migrations over the centuries. We get the impression that the only people that travel around today get on a jet and they fly off to so-and-so, you know, or came here in the late 19th or early 20th century. But those migrations have always been going on, always been going on. And the more we know, you know, the more we realize how integrated we really are.
We're just migrating faster now because of the invention of the airplane and the cars and things like that. Exactly. It's just a faster movement. That's what it is. And I think a lot of the reaction of currently in the United States, at least, and other countries as well, are reacting to this as well. The reaction to this super change, super fast change, is really upsetting some people, right? So it really throws them off their game. And so they don't see the mission creep of the ancient migrations were more mission creepy. In other words, they happened and it just wasn't noticeable in the news. You know what I mean? And now it's happening so, you know, lightning fast that people are getting upset about it, because people don't like their culture change too fast. You know, they like the same songs that they used to like. They like the same, you know, foods that they used to like. And if it changes too fast for them, it throws them off. And because we're humans, right? We get thrown off that game. So that's kind of how that works, and that's kind of how we're going through right now, I think, is globalization is really a little fast for the human species, I think. I might be too fast for our brain. I don't know.
I do think that. I think we're backing off. I think the world is actually backing off this concept of rapid globalization.
And going back to local?
Going back to local. I think it's the only way we're going to be
able
to survive.
Think global, act local.
Exactly.
Well, you know, on that note, we're coming up to the end of the show. Go ahead and tell our listeners and readers all over the world how they can find you, what's coming up with what you're doing, and, you know, give us all the details, everything like that.
Okay, well, we have a website that is available, valediction.net, where you can find all of our work. We have all kinds of documents going back to the work we did with CBS and ABC and the news stories that we covered and the transition that we went through into the mystical with Oliver Stone and the work we did with him. And the actual document that we sent him originally, which was this original Fitzgerald history that really inaugurated us into the deep esoteric history. So that's all there, including all of our books. So we hope you'll make a stop there first. And we are working towards this event for the convention that's coming up for the 60th anniversary of the assassination of JFK. We're going to be inaugurating this into the discussion, which really is, I believe, the first time this kind of discussion has been brought into this kind of convention. Most of these conventions have focused on the current era's geopolitical and the arguments between which one of the current potential assassins do you believe really did it. And so this is, you know, where we're bringing this new underlying motivational structure that some people really have already identified, you know, like someone like Alan Dulles, okay, who clearly had a current geopolitical connection, but you also have to look at this esoteric connection. He represents both at the same time. The belief that the United States basically was created for the people who were actually against Rome, did not want Rome to have anything to do with the creation or with anything about the United States, who felt that, in fact, when JFK was running for president, there were many people claiming at the time he was going to be run by the Pope. So you know that there was a very deep-seated concern about those influences. And I think that, so it's a mix between ancient historical and esoteric motivations mixing with the current politics. And that really is kind of what the CIA represents.
I mean, people don't realize that, you know, all the major universities in the United States were all founded as religious institutions. You know, I mean, I went to BU. I didn't realize that it was a Methodist college. And, you know, it had been founded at, and it spread out from over the century as, you know, as something else, as more secular. But the fact is that the foundation of all of these things were rooted in Judeo-Christianity. You know, and so we're, you know, it is reflected in their presentations.
Well, it's going to be an exciting year for you guys. You're going to be heading down to, are you going to be doing this event in Dallas?
In Dallas.
Yeah, that's where they
Well, we want definitely to do a podcast live from Dallas. What do you say about that?
That'll be fun. We'll look forward to it.
I want to speak to the VT listeners out there. Guys, just really quick, get your VT cup. Don't forget, it's online at vtforeignpolicy.com. And if you like the show, please support us by becoming a member of VT. It's over on our site, vtforeignpolicy.com, where we ask you to join with the we use buymeacoffee.com, and there it's really simple to join. You just put your information in and become a member. It's $8 a month, and that would really help out VT, keeping us on the radio, keeping us on the internets all over the place and all over the world. So I just want to say thank you to all the VT listeners out there and say fantastic, Paul. Thank you for being on, and thank you, Liz, for sharing all your knowledge with us. And I want to wish you a fabulous day.
Thank you, John.
Take care, folks.
If you enjoyed this presentation, hit the like button now. Also, share it with your friends. And don't forget to subscribe so that you don't miss an episode.
VT approves this message.